Bitcoin is the only instantly tradable global asset in the world. And because it's on the internet, anybody with an internet connection in any country in the world can get access to it. And because it's fractionalizable, here you've got an asset recordable on this ledger system that is instantaneously transferable and anybody can put 10% of their wages in. And so what it means is everybody rises together, as opposed to, well, a bunch of rich people, they get rich and the poor people are just wage slaves. But this changes that equation.
You're listening to Because of Bitcoin, a podcast that shares the personal stories of how Bitcoin is having a real impact in people's lives, including mine. I'm your host, Mauricio Di Bartolomeo, the co-founder and CSO of Ledin. And without further ado, let's get started with today's story. Even in free market economies like the United States, their government is still pretty involved in setting targets for the economy. In other words, the government has the ability to press on the gas or hit the brakes on its economy artificially when it feels appropriate to do so. We saw this during the recent pandemic. When the economy shut down, they stimulated it by sending checks to people. When the economy overheated, they jacked up interest rates and slowed down inflation. Their influence touches everything from grocery bills to gold prices. Because of this, it's important to understand the lens through which the government views the economy, and that's macroeconomics. Understanding the broader trends in the market can help you identify investment opportunities and timing. And few people have done that better over time than Raoul Paul. In this episode, Raoul shares his journey and insights that have shaped his understanding of global markets from his early days growing up in a business-savvy family to his illustrious career at Goldman Sachs and beyond. We explore the parallels between past financial crises and today's crypto landscape, the evolution of his investment strategies, and his bold predictions for the future of digital assets. Whether you're a seasoned investor or just curious about the forces driving today's financial world, I know you'll gain valuable perspectives and actionable insights. So sit back, relax, and get ready to unfuck your future with Raoul Paul. The man, the legend. How are you, Raoul?
I'm good, my friend. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for coming on the show. I've been really looking forward to our chat. And now that we're both Cayman-based, hopefully this is the first of many.
Yeah, although we're on two different islands today. Otherwise, we could have done this in person. But there we go.
The next one, we'll shoot to do in person. But it's your first time on the show. And I don't know if you're familiar with the show. So the way I like to start is by asking a little bit about the story behind what you see today. And I always like starting this show by asking my guests about their upbringing. So how was it like growing up in the Paul family? And was money or finance a big theme in your family?
So I grew up with an Indian father and a Dutch mother who met on a blind date in England. And we lived mainly just outside London, but we also lived for a period of time in India. My father's background, he was in marketing. So he worked for Xerox and ran European marketing for Xerox when Xerox was a huge company in the late 70s, early 80s. And then he had a few jobs before setting up his own kind of exec search headhunting firm and kind of management consulting business. So we grew up around business, talking about business, you know, the breakfast table or the lunch table or the dinner table. There'll be a lot of that. So much so that dad became a mentor to a lot of my friends when they're like, what am I supposed to do for a living? Some of them weren't going to university. And his advice generally was, well, if you're a likable person, become a salesman because you can always sell something. So I grew up around that. And then when I was choosing my career, I'd gone and studied economics and law at a terrible university, the only one that would accept me because I discovered cars, girls, pubs, all of that stuff. So only one university accepted me down in Plymouth, but I graduated, did decently well there, and I graduated right into a recession, 1990. And I remember it was dad's birthday and a friend of his said to me, well, what do you want to do now for a career? And I said, listen, I like marketing. I had been interviewing at the typical FMCG marketing firms, Procter & Gamble and all of that, but really finance was what interested me because the 80s had just happened. You know, it was all of these people drinking champagne and driving Porsches. And there was the film Wall Street. It was really cultural. And I'm like, you know, I really want to do that. And I'd written my dissertation at university about junk bonds. And the guy looked at me and said, it's a pretty easy decision, Raoul. He said, you can go and work in marketing for Mars, fantastic consumer goods company, and you'll get free Mars bars. Or you can go and work for a bank and you'll get free money. I mean, so true, right? This arbitrage between basically the same job, selling product, and one would pay 10x what the other one paid. So it took me a while to get there, but eventually got into the city in London and then eventually into Goldman and then running hedge funds and all that stuff.
Wow, that's brilliant. And I see a lot of parallels. I had a similar upbringing experience. My dad was also the mentor for a lot of my friends, and my dad was a big salesman. He would always say, sales is where it's at. My dad used to say, sales is the bloodline of a business. So if you have a great business and no sales, you have nothing. If you have sales and no business, you can make it. Because it's the sort of blood that makes the system run. And so it's fascinating to see people have similar experiences. You mentioned Goldman, and before you started Real Vision, which I believe was a decade ago, you had an illustrious career in finance. And one of the things that we discussed briefly and I've read about is your story and your involvement around long-term capital management. And when I heard you talk about it and I was reading your story in Real Vision, I started getting a lot of deja vu. And it was very reminiscent of what we just experienced with FTX. And I wanted to ask you, for those who are maybe not too familiar with the story, could you just briefly describe how you identified the risk that long-term capital management was posing to the industry while you were working at Goldman Sachs?
It was actually before Goldman when I was at NatWest. They were my biggest client, and I was in equity derivatives. And what they were doing was putting in trades which were like Shell, the oil company, trades in London and Holland, Unilever, London and Holland, Hong Kong, Shanghai Bank, London, and Hong Kong. And they were arbitraging the spread between the two. People might think of it now as arbitraging the Bitcoin ETF with MicroStrategies. But there were many hedge funds into these trades. But these guys came in, and let's say I was dealing with the next largest hedge fund, whoever it may have been at the time, they would have done $50 or $100 million of the trade. Long-term capital were putting $1 billion plus in each one of these trades. They then were doing volatility arbitrage. Because there was a structure of pension funds buying longer-dated volatility for guaranteed fund products, it had made long-term volatility higher than where it actually traded. It was abnormally high at a premium. And so they put these gigantic volatility selling strategies on. And again, in preposterous size. I mean, unheard of size. So I, as a salesman, loved it. They were my biggest client. I was making a shit ton of money. I was making all the commissions from that. But they were also doing this, not just with us, most banks, and they were doing it in fixed income and foreign exchange and other markets, even bigger size. But we didn't really understand that. And then I went on a stag weekend with a whole group of friends to Kilkenny in Ireland. And we're on a boat fishing and drinking and chatting. And I'm like, to a friend of mine, who's your biggest client? He goes, long-term capital. I said, how much have you got? He goes, I don't know, we got $1 billion or $2 billion. So he was at Salomon. Then the next guy asked him, he was at JP Morgan, I think it was, said, how much have you got? He's like, yeah, we've got probably a couple of billion, $3 billion or so. And I'm like, okay, well, at NatWest, we probably had $4 billion because I obviously was a better salesman than them. So we had larger size and I knew other banks had some preposterous size. Then another friend was the head of bond trading at Deutsche Bank. And I'm like, who's your biggest client? He's like, long-term capital. I'm like, how much have you got? He goes, I don't know, 100 billion, 50 billion, whatever the stupid number was. Now, long-term capital at the time were running about 2 or 3 billion. So you've got to understand the obscene amount of leverage. And this was being facilitated by the prime broking desks of banks. I actually came back from the stag weekend and went to speak to the risk manager at NatWest and said, this is a problem. So we started trying to get out of this because I was worried, you know. There was just too much leverage and it was all too opaque. Just nobody knew, no risk manager at any bank knew what was on at other banks. And long-term capital was so big a client, they would kind of bully you into non-disclosure agreements and stuff like that. And then I moved across to Goldman and the Asian crisis happened. And as the Asian crisis happened, what happened was liquidity started disappearing from the system and the trades that these guys had on started widening and they started adding to them because they thought they were the smartest people in the world. And they added and added. And then smaller funds started blowing up. And then all of these positions, which were the same positions everybody had, all puke. And the spreads just went super wide and the whole thing blew up. It blew up so badly that the Fed had to cut rates from one hedge fund. And I've learned in my career that if anybody is the biggest client of the street in terms of lending or borrowing, it's generally a problem. And I had seen that before. Baring Brothers back in the early 90s, the biggest trader of Nikkei volatility in the world was this guy called Nick Leeson. Nick Leeson became famous for blowing up Baring Brothers, the oldest bank in the world. And same story ad infinitum. And so once the unraveling started happening in 2022, I realized that there was only one borrower, basically, in all of crypto, which was Three Arrows Capital. And nobody knew. Everybody had one counterparty, and nobody knew there was only one counterparty.
You'd be proud to know that Three Arrows came by our desk three times asking for a borrow, and we rejected them all three times because a very simple requirement we have for institutional counterparts is financial statements. And they kept trying to give us this one-page document signed by Kyle saying, trust me, I got it. And we said, we're going to need more than that. And they said, you're the only lender not lending to us. And we said, we'll wear that with pride.
But you still feel the ramifications, right? Because the whole market blows up. And nobody's lending and nobody's borrowing. And it's a real mess, right? And it was hard for people who had good processes in place. It was a tough time for everybody. And that's what happens in this.
I remember having conversations with our clients that were withdrawing assets from LedIn to take them to Celsius because they were paying 12 and we were paying 9 in our stablecoin savings accounts. And I would say, this is your money. Take it, please. But I can show you where I get my 9. I borrow from you at 9. I lend to my clients at 12. My rates are posted. You can see my spread. Ask them how they're getting 12 because I don't see them lending at 12. In fact, they're lending at 1% because they're doing all sorts of things with your collateral. So ask the questions. But to your point, we're a zero rate environment. People are starving for yield. Asset prices are flying and they just go for the incremental next best thing, not knowing that they're taking an insurmountable mountain of risk for that incremental percent. It's really hard to get people to think diligently when things are riding high.
Well, because what happens is everybody loses their minds. So everybody looks for the cheapest borrow, the cheapest capital without questioning why is it cheap. You know, it's the people who want to lend to you the least is who you actually want to borrow money from.
That rings true. And it's easier said than done to stay rational in a time of irrational exuberance. Much easier said than done.
You know, looking back at long-term capital, it was a fight to lower rates because we're all competing for this business. And it's very difficult as a business to say, we're not going to do that. We're not going to give you these prime broking terms. We're not going to give you this swap terms because then you are definitely not going to get the business. And because of the profit motive, you end up doing it.
Kudos to you for, even though you were in sales and even though identifying them and basically dismantling those positions hurt your own book, I think it's very commendable.
Well, I made the money all over again on the unwind because right. Goldman, I got called by, on a Sunday, I was in New York, and I got called by David Rogers, who was the partner who ran equity derivatives at Goldman. He called me up and said, come and see me at the Trump Plaza Hotel or whatever it was. So I turn up there on a Sunday in New York, and he's like, meet John Merriweather, meet all of the partners of long-term capital. It was the weekend after they blew up. And they're like, listen, we just want your advice on how we're going to unwind this. And so Dave Rogers was seconded to long-term capital to unwind. And then an auction for all of these trades to be unwound, of which we managed to do a ton of those too. So managed to put the trades on and unwind the trades. So made quite a lot of money in my career from that.
Well, hey, doing the right thing pays off. And I'm happy that that's how it worked out for you. So you did all of this in TradFi. When and how do you find Bitcoin?
So 2008 happened and I was lucky enough to see it coming. And I was writing about it in my research service, Global Macro Investor, which I've been writing now for 20 years. And the heart of that in a debt crisis was that collateral was being rehypothecated. So that means the same collateral is being reused, right? Same as long-term capital management, same as Three Arrows Capital, it's the same shit. But this was at the entire banking system level. So the collateral was being reused. Things like US government bonds were being repledged up to 40 times. Insanity. And nobody really knew. It was so opaque. So when it blows up, what happened was there's not enough collateral to go around and everything pukes and the Fed had to come in and debase currency essentially to make the collateral look like it's rising in value and started protecting it because the housing market had done it. All sorts of aspects had done it. Then 2012 happened, and most people in the US or the Americas don't really understand 2012, but the whole of fucking Europe almost blew up. Every single government almost blew up in Europe. So the government bond markets in Europe started dislocating, and banks were blowing up. Real estate markets were imploding. It was a follow-on. It was the same rolling debt crisis. Well, it was kind of the Asian debt crisis rolled into another debt. It's all the same excess leverage that washes around the system that we'd built up in the 90s and 80s. But Europe, it was at government level. And you start to see French spreads, Portuguese spreads. Eventually, Greece blows up. Cyprus blows up. I am in Spain. I have to have a generator and tinned food. I thought we were going to lose the banks. The ECB forced Spain, because Spain's a very proud nation, they forced them to take $19 billion one weekend as a bailout. They may not have done it otherwise, and we'd have lost our entire banking system. Many of my parents' friends and friends all blew up over this. Yeah, banks just confiscated money. But the signal for me was Cyprus. Cyprus, this small island, its banking system was wildly overleveraged. It blew up. And instead of bailing out the banks, US style and UK style, the EU said, you know what? We're going to do something different. We're going to bail in the depositors. So there's people thinking, oh, my money in a bank is my money. And the EU said, no, we share the losses amongst the creditors and the debtors. And you were guaranteed for 100,000 euros and anything above that. So imagine you are a gas station and you might have several million euros, but you're making wafer thin margins, several million euros in your bank account gone. I had friends who had sold a house and were taking the money out, gone. And what I realized is nobody owns anything in the financial system. I found out that at the epicenter of all of the government bond market is the DTCC and Euroclear, which are these huge opaque pools of clearing, custody, collateral management. And within that, you actually don't own your own assets. And at personal level, you don't own your own assets. So I'm like, okay, this is so bad that I went around the world trying to start the world's safest bank with a couple of famous hedge fund guys and a few family offices. And we went to Singapore, Switzerland, the UK, and the US, and we almost opened a Texas Trust Bank. And we had the ex-chairman of the FDIC was going to be the chairman of the bank. We found a bank to buy, and we went to the Dallas Fed and said, here's our plan, expecting it to be approved. And what our idea was no leverage whatsoever. So any deposit would be matched with a treasuries held direct with a Federal Reserve. So we went to the Dallas Fed, said, could a bank hold treasuries direct with you? Yes, of course. Even for customers, yes, of course. Okay, we're going to start this non-leveraged bank. And they said, this is a really good idea. And we said, thank you. You know, we think it's really needed. And they said, and nobody's ever going to give you a license. And we said, why? They said, because you'll take all the deposits from the banking system. I'm like, huh.
For those not too familiar with how the banking system works, I think what you were trying to do is basically put an override on FDIC insurance and insure the whole thing because there would be no risk.
Yeah, I mean, it's a non-fractional reserve bank.
And in some ways, I would say that that's partially what Caitlin Long is trying to recreate.
She's tried the same thing and they've said the same answer. And so Caitlin's, yeah, exactly trying to do the same thing. We went down that route. It didn't work. So I was writing this up in Global Macro Investor because it was a fascinating story of the time. And one of my clients, a guy called Emil Wood and another one called Chad Cascarilla, they were running a hedge fund in New York and had started mining Bitcoin because they had free electricity in their offices. So we're talking 2012, I'm writing this story up. By 2013, Chad and Emil had set up ItBit, an exchange both in Singapore and the US, now Paxos. And Emil said, I think your answer is Bitcoin. The Cyprus thing, Bitcoin spiked. And that was the time I got in and I bought Bitcoin at $200 in 2013. And then I wrote the first ever macro strategy piece on Bitcoin and how to value it back in 2013. I can't quite believe I did that, but I did. So that's been my journey. And then with Real Vision, which we started in 2014, I knew that we had to educate people in the fragilities of the system and how to navigate it and what to do. And they were not getting advice by the centralized people. And Occupy Wall Street had shown us that they'd lost faith in the middlemen, the gatekeepers. And so Real Vision was there to democratize. And the very first video we had was about Bitcoin. And we carried that story. We've had every single OG in the history of crypto, people that people don't even know of anymore, but true OGs like Wences Caceres have been on Real Vision. You know, Barry Silbert was on all of the time. There was a guy called Trace Mayers who's disappeared as well. He was on Real Vision educating people what Bitcoin is. Chad Cascarilla did a whole series on how to invest in Bitcoin, how to think about blockchain. So we took many, many people down that journey.
That's fascinating. And basically, Real Vision is an OG institution in the sense that you guys, you've done a lot of that first ever research. You've brought on a lot of those OG, like people that the school of 2014 or later won't really remember. Guys like Wences, guys like Trace, they were almost like the Michael Saylors of today back then. They were revered by the community. And for whatever reasons, have kind of dropped off the scene, similar to even Andreas, right? Like
yes.
Andreas was another example.
And he's been on Real Vision a few times. You know, they've all been.
Yeah. Well, we'll get into this later, but a lot of our clients who are OGs are very long-term subscribers to Real Vision. And I don't think that's a surprise, but I'm going to save that for later because there's a lot of overlap. Even in our thinking, we've set out to build the safest financial services platform ever because we could use the transparency of Bitcoin as the backbone. And that, in many ways, is what Ledin does today.
And that was my idea because the idea I had was you can own the collateral and it's provable.
Correct. So we do that today with custody loans. And I see a future where today our loans, we have a product where the collateral just sits in custody and doesn't get rehypothecated. And I think that we can even go further down in the future to show people on-chain proof that the collateral is rehypothecated. Right now it's in our agreement, but we're working to get it such that it's shown on the chain and so that there's absolutely no question of where the collateral is.
Yeah, and that's what exactly I saw in Bitcoin was this. I'm like, everything can be now proven where the collateral is and who owns it.
100%.
That couldn't happen in the traditional financial system. And by the way, we could probably put stocks and bonds and everything else on this, like everything will go. And that's what I saw in 2013. I can't quite believe I did, but that's what I did. And it's still the same direction we're headed in.
It's brilliant. And congratulations on all of the success. You should be very proud. I want to ask you about your evolution since getting into Bitcoin, because there's some, you know, obviously changes since 2014. In November 2020, you famously said, this was on Twitter or an interview that I read, that you had 70% of your liquid net worth in BTC. And as of recently, you have reported that your allocation is about sub 10% altcoins, including Smoking Chicken Fish and Doge. And that's about 90% Solana. I don't know if that's changed, but you're also a believer in Sui. So my question to you is, are you fully out of Bitcoin now? And if so, why is that?
I own one Bitcoin. And it's nothing to do with, is Bitcoin good or bad? Of course, it's amazing, right? I'm not after the attributes of the perfect pristine collateral, which is a term I coined back in 2020. I'm not after that right now. What I'm after is to unfuck my future, is to make as much wealth as I can. And so listen, I've been in financial markets for 30 odd years, and my job is to try and outperform. And so I made the switch in November 2020 towards Ethereum, and I ended up being 75% Ethereum for 2021. That was a home run. Then I remained Ethereum, and then in June 2022, when Three Arrows blew up, I started buying Solana a bit early, but I started allocating to Solana, and then I got rid of the rest of my Bitcoin and added it into Sol mainly, and a bit of ETH, I think. And then as I figured out what was happening with Firedancer, where it was all going, looking at the Solana cross rates against ETH, Solana cross rates against Bitcoin, I realized it was going to break out. So I went all in Sol because I had confidence, because it was being battle tested. It had gone down to $8. It was still thriving as an ecosystem. And so I thought, here was a trade. Now that was another home run. Luckily, I seem to have got these asset allocations pretty right. And then I'm on the board of the Sui Foundation. So I have been given tokens there, but I actually started using the same process I did with Ethereum and Solana, looking at the cross rates, looking at the charts, looking at the adoption, seeing all of this, thinking, you know what, this might well be the next chosen one, the Solana of this cycle. So I started allocating more money to that. So I'm probably 10% in or even less in memes and stuff like that. Probably 20% maybe in Sui, and then basically the balance in 70 in Solana. And then the other thing I have been doing is top slicing my Solana profits and buying high-end art NFTs.
Wow, that's brilliant. And you go through a lot of this on Real Vision. So I've
been very public in my journey. I mean, I write about it in Global Macro Investor, which is this serious research service for kind of high net worths, family offices, hedge funds. That's why I'm over in Little Cayman right now, because I write it once a month. That's the DNA of everything. Then it spills out into Real Vision Pro Macro. It spills out some of my Twitter conversations, and it's just kind of less detail. So then my YouTube, Raoul Powell, the Journeyman, and occasionally I'll catch everybody up with, okay, this is where I am, and I do a big long piece. So everybody's on an equal playing field. But generally, yeah, it comes from GMI and then moves out.
I'm a big fan, always have been, since I found you many years ago. And we'll get into what everyone can get and learn from your show. But you put out an immense amount of value, I would say, in alpha from practice and experience, not just some guy staring at charts. You've gone and done it. And that's what I really love about your research. I have a question here that maybe we can get some defined goalposts on some of these things that are abstract concepts. You've said that Sui and Solana have about 5 to 10x of upside in the long term. I think you said this in a recent Drinks with Raoul. And I guess my question is, what does long term mean in the context of macro and the business cycle? Is there a defined term for that?
Without getting into price predictions, from here, can Sol hit 1,000? Okay, that's a 5x, roughly. Yeah, that seems about right. Will it definitely get there? No idea. Could it overshoot that? Yes. Could it undershoot it? Yes, of course. Sui, which is earlier stage adoption with a lower free float, tend to move faster in a bull market and the reverse in a bear market. So can Sui, which is now around $2, can that go to $20, $10? Yeah, it's as simple as that. And, you know, that's taking into account how other tokens have moved in past cycles. So really, the end of this cycle is somewhere late 2025. So this is why it's called the banana zone, because returns go exponential in the latter part and all the charts go bananas.
So we're going to get to the yellow fruit. I have to check because we're bouncing in and out of 70, so I don't know what to call it.
We can't really call it that.
We're both summoning it, but we don't know what to call it. So the follow-on question from that is, what do you believe Bitcoin could do in a similar time frame?
Well, there's a number of ways of doing Bitcoin. I use the log linear regression channel. Other people hate that and use the log channel with the curve, or you can just use straightforward technical analysis. Either way, it seems the most likely range is 150 to 450 with 200-ish being medium. Now, we've had different cycles. You know, 2013 was a blow-off. 2017 was a blow-off. The previous cycle was a truncated cycle. We didn't get the blow-off top. So that's kind of the range. The hard thing is we don't know. I mean, I never forget. Just because a lot of people only understand last cycle, which was a truncated cycle. People don't realize I sold my Bitcoin that I bought at $200. I sold it at $2,000, 10x. I'm like, I'm a god. I'm clearly George Soros, one of the greatest traders the world has ever seen. I sold it because there was these forking wars going on in Bitcoin. And I'm like, I don't understand. Am I going to back the right chain? I'm not in the space deep enough to know what the hell I'm doing. So I sold out and the price was starting to correct. It corrected and then rallied 10x into the end of the year in 4 months and ended up at 20,000. And people just don't understand. That is very difficult to deal with on a number of levels. Because if you ride it all the way, it then V-shape goes down again, the Mount Fuji pattern, or you sell out too early and then it's like 10x are left on the table. So it is bloody difficult to do.
I remember those days very well because my family started mining in Venezuela around 2015 and nobody knew about Bitcoin. Nobody knew what it was. All of a sudden it goes from 600 to 1,000, 1,000 to 2,000 and then corrects, fork wars. But then we moon to 20. I remember thinking to myself, because in Venezuela, you went from being excited to fearing for your own safety if people found out you have Bitcoin. And so it was a really dramatic shift. And I think it just shocked people into saying, what is this thing? It's hard to describe. It was hard to believe it was real. It was just such a big change. But now that we're on the topic, I guess Bitcoin, I got to check the price, but it's seven. I'm trying to decide what to call it.
So Bitcoin has broken out-ish of the consolidation pattern. But to call it the yellow fruit zone, to give it its official name, the one that all of our hopes and dreams are in, we kind of need more breakouts. Like Solana needs to be above 185. We need to see ETH breaking its recent range. We need to see a structure of a market that looks like alts and the whole market want to catapult higher. It's not good enough just to have Bitcoin because it could be Sailor in the market. There's, you know, one large player in the market, stuff like that. So we need to see the whole space and we're not there yet. I mean, we got to 73 and a bit on Bitcoin, which is approaching the all-time high. while Solana hit 180 something but didn't break, and it's all backed off a bit. And I think that makes sense because we're talking here today and we're a few days away from the election. And I think the market doesn't want to commit until it figures it out.
I have a very similar view. I don't think we're going to see anything. If anything, it'll be like a very tamed all-time high going into the elections. Maybe we get a sell the news event and perhaps we rally higher again.
Well, we don't have long. I mean, we got 4 days.
Just from my conversations with clients and such, I think a lot of people have been trying to front run or position themselves for a potential Trump win. And so that kind of gets the market a little ahead of itself, I find. And then even if we get the outcome that a lot of people are hoping for or positioning themselves for, I still think we correct down. But that's just my very personal view.
Yeah, what we often get is a week or so of a blast off rally, then a correction and retest, and then it's clean. We've had that before in the past, and that was 2016, I think.
And I'm going to ask you about the election because I think it's big, but I loved your banana zone yellow fruit thesis on Bitcoin and digital assets. For those unfamiliar with it, could you just briefly describe what you mean? And I'm going to follow on this with a question about the everything code, because
they
I think
are.
They're both related in some ways. But I wanted to hear your kind of, you know, elevator pitch on the banana zone thesis for those unfamiliar.
The banana zone thesis is the fact that every 4 years around the election year, a bunch of things come together that tend to ignite asset prices and particularly has a huge influence on crypto because it's the most exponential of all assets. And it's driven by the election cycle. Really what it's driven by is the liquidity cycle. It's the rolling over of debts and having to provide liquidity to do it. At time of speaking, the bond market's not liking the Fed issue, the Treasury issuing new bonds, and it's freaking out, and the UK gilts market's freaking out a bit. It's because there's not enough liquidity there to absorb the bonds. So we know we've got $10 trillion of this stuff to roll, and they're going to have to figure out how to inject that liquidity into the system. And it generally starts in the last quarter of the year and then keeps going. Now, it also ties in with the fact that the back half of every year, particularly in the last quarter, the Chinese increase liquidity for their own purposes internally. So they've got that liquidity cycle, which is an annual one. There's an annual debt cycle within the US, a liquidity cycle. There is a 4-year liquidity cycle. There is an election cycle, risk-taking, you know, like we're to say, people don't take risk, wait for the outcome, whatever the outcome, take risk. And then we've got the global debt refi cycle because the Europeans, the UK, the Chinese, the Japanese, everyone's in the same boat. So it tends to produce charts that go bananas. A, it looks like a banana because it just curves up like that. And B, the markets are bananas, like we were talking about, you know, 10x in the last 4 months of the year in Bitcoin. That's bananas. And so that's what it is. And people clung onto this thing because it's funny, right? Bananas are funny. They're slightly phallic as well. We just minted some NFTs for people, which is unfuck your future with a banana. And everybody's hopes and dreams are in it because that's the process of accelerated gains that crypto does, which has unfucked so many people's future. It's why crypto over time gets more people from, I haven't got any money to now I can buy a house or now I can realize that future vision of myself. Because crypto is the largest wealth generating machine the world has ever seen. We've got to $2 trillion, basically memed $2 trillion into existence so far. And I think we're on our way to $100 trillion in 10 years time. And this cycle will finish at $10 to $15 trillion. So that's a lot of wealth that we're generating. Now, unlike other times, this is not via intermediaries. This is average people. This is retail front running everybody else. The first time the pyramid's been inverted. So it matters.
I think that the way you crystallize some of these concepts into actionable trades and why is why your research and your content resonates with so many people. And I went to business school. I went to finance. I've always been obsessed with how money works. And it was not until Bitcoin and later on in life when I started really peeling back the onions on macro. And I went from a guy that used to think bonds were the most boring things in the world to I actually get so hyped up about bonds right now. To me, it's like I look at bonds before I look at equities because one drives the other. I think most macro investors believe at its core that most asset prices are driven more so than anything else by global liquidity. And I think this goes back to your everything.
I don't know if they agree that, Mauricio. I don't think they do. I think traditional macro people don't really understand liquidity. So they will say rates are the driver or whatever, but I don't think most people fully understand liquidity, and then they certainly don't understand debasement because it's not part of their economic models.
I wholeheartedly agree with you, and I actually saw this play out in real life. In Argentina, we've seen inflation of 100% with rates at 60.
I've also said that I've always used Venezuelan stock market as the example. It's the best performing stock market in the world in Bolivar. When it in dollars, it's down 95%.
Correct. And some people think, oh, Argentinian yield. I'm like, you have to net off the yield from inflation. You guys don't get it. And I think those that have experienced things like you, for example, you've lived all over the world. You've worked with really global entities. I find that the more worldview macro people I speak with, they understand it. It's the people that tend to have been siloed in a particular country or haven't had that exposure of a bank failure. My grandfather lost assets when the bank got bailed in. You know, in Venezuela, in Latam, you bail in the banks. You bail in the depositors. You don't bail out the banks.
Remember the Corralito in Argentina?
El Corralito, claro. El Corralito is exactly that. So people that have been through this, and I actually think this is why crypto is more poised to favor people that have seen this type of stuff. And that's why we run to it before we run into anything else. Not only do we know why or have a reason, but we don't really have any options. Venezuela is by Bitcoin or else. There's no NVIDIA. There's no Apple.
So that's another key thing. Okay, so debasement and all of that. Great. We've got this asset. People, again, don't realize. I like to get everything down to its simple, most common understanding, right? Try and get out of the mid curve and get either on the left or the right. Bitcoin is the only instantly tradable global asset in the world. And because it's on the internet, anybody with an internet connection in any country in the world can get access to it. Sometimes it can be more difficult, but generally speaking, and because it's fractionalizable, which nothing else is, yes, a dollar is, but dollars are not available to Filipinos and Indonesians and Nigerians. Here you've got a global transferable asset recordable on this ledger system that is instantaneously transferable, and anybody can put 10% of their wages in. Anybody. And so what it means is everybody rises together, as opposed to, well, a bunch of rich people, they can buy high-end real estate and they can get into hedge funds and they can get into this. They get rich and the poor people are just wage slaves. But this changes that equation. So there's nothing like it. Gold is similar, but if you go to a village in India and by gold, you're crossing a bid offer spread that can be up to 50%. In Bitcoin, it's nothing.
Not to mention, you can do a fraction of the things with gold than you can do with Bitcoin. You can do foreign settlement. You can buy things abroad. There's so many things that you can do with Bitcoin, to your point, that aren't available with gold. And it's funny, a while back, people were complaining that Bitcoin was trading like the S&P 500. And I would go back to them and say, do you know that Bitcoin trading like the S&P 500 is an actual gift from the heavens for people everywhere in the world that can't access the S&P 500?
And they can't buy Tesla. And they can't, as you said before, they can't buy NVIDIA. You know, if you're in Nigeria, you can't access that. You know, you might be lucky and live in a country like India that's had a secularly bullish stock market, but most people don't. And even that's hard to open an account in India. It's not for the average person. It may be okay for the middle classes, but
with same issues in Venezuela. Switching gears for a second, what are you paying attention to in this market?
I'm seeing the signs of a gigantic leverage cycle about to happen again. And this is going to be around MicroStrategies, I think. And it's not so much their leverage, it's about all the people doing the arbitrage, going back to our long-term capital. So people are doing a number of things. They're using the ETF because they can get prime broking on it, and then shorting MicroStrategy at a simple, like, this should be a relationship. That's not a great strategy, but I can understand in a long, short book, people might want that. There's then the convert arb guys who are buying the converts, and they will be hedging out some of the risk, and then they may be trading the volatility, i.e. the option premium. So you've got implicit leverage that goes on. You've got the same players doing the ETF versus the futures arbitrage to try and keep that in line. And there's other players, more crypto native, who are doing either the futures or the ETF versus the perps arbitrage. But really, there's one facilitator of all of this. So if we go back to what happened, it wasn't Three Arrows Capital that blew up the world. It was one vehicle that created gigantic leverage, and that was the Grayscale Bitcoin Trust. So what was it doing? It was trading at a premium. So what the hedge fund's doing, they were buying spot, selling. It's the same with MicroStrategies. And so Barry was not doing anything bad. Now, Genesis and stuff like that finally got caught out. But generally, the grayscale thing was not, people used to complain about the premium, but he couldn't control that. That was driven by market conditions. But we are seeing the exact same in MicroStrategies. And people are forgetting that that arbitrage is what built all of the leverage, all of the borrowing, all of the funding markets, everything came from one trade.
That's a fascinating take, and I'm sure people will find very insightful.
Now, the difference is we don't know who the big borrower is or the lenders are, because it seems that this is traditional hedge funds that are doing this trade.
Yeah, this is securities brokerage, right? Like, this wouldn't necessarily be a CeFi or a crypto issue. This would be a TradFi issue.
That's right. This is where you could blow up the prime broking desk because Millennium has a huge hole, or whoever it may be, right? But those hedge funds who do this, A, they're much bigger. B, they can manage risk better. So maybe it's not so bad, and it's just a credit spasm that goes through the markets for a while and then frees up once the market clears. But it's early days. He's just announced another $42 billion of this shit to go. And it depends how much that all gets reused within the system.
That's fascinating, Ra. Last question before we go into where people can find more about you. By the time this episode airs, we'll have a new US president. Do you anticipate making or having to make any changes to your portfolio depending on the outcome, or are we just going to ride the global liquidity wave here?
Yeah, no, I have no difference. Let's say if there was a clear, undeniable Trump sweep, essentially, then I think there's some equities that make a lot of sense. Tesla being one, because Elon were basically in the government, and the other will be Coinbase, because they had the super PAC and everything else. So on crypto side, no, nothing changes. I'm 100% all in anyway. I'm 100% of my liquid net worth, so I can't do anything. And if Harris gets in and the market doesn't like it, maybe it pukes 15, 20% and then it'll just go back up again. So it really makes no difference to me on my time horizon.
What's next for you and Real Vision? Any special events, anything you want to let our listeners know about?
There's a lot going on because we've now got this incredible trade ideas on the platform where we've got thousands of members putting up their own trade ideas. Some of them are in meme coins, some of them are in equity, some of them other stuff. But we've now got this kind of whole community of ideas flowing, and there's been competitions, and the first competition has just closed out. I think the winner did 180% returns in 2 months. It's bananas. I mean, some of the returns, I thought I did well. I put a stock called Rocket Labs and it was up 70% and I came like 18th. I'm like, wow. So there's some very smart people there. We're working on a big crypto gathering event in Miami in January. So we're going to get everybody together there. That'll be a lot of fun. But there's always a lot going on at Real Vision. Lots of fabulous interviews, lots of great research. And then a lot of this kind of user-generated content of trade ideas and notes and all of that kind of stuff that's ongoing.
Well, I strongly encourage anyone that hasn't registered, go check out Real Vision.
Realvision.com/join. It's free. And just go and see the quality of what's there, the discourse, because we kind of showed everybody how to do the macro crypto thing. That's all on Real Vision. What people see on my YouTube channel, The Journeyman, is a fraction of all of the great minds, because I may have an opinion and maybe I've been right, but I'll also be very wrong. But what Real Vision gives you is that ability to get broad opinions from a whole host of people so you can build your own investing framework and kind of unfuck your own future. Yeah, realvision.com/join. Just do yourself a favor, do that.
Definitely. I've done myself a favor. And I will say to people that even just comparing your Spotify podcast versus the on-screen Real Vision experience, it's a mile of difference.
Well, because you got the AI summaries, the transcripts,
the charts are what did it for me. You being able to show the charts, that was brilliant. So much of the stuff is data, right? And I think it transfers across video way better. And you guys have all the bells and whistles, the quality of the video, everything is just top-notch. So very much encourage people to go check it out. Where can our readers find out more about you and your work? Is there anywhere else you want to point them to?
Well, the easiest one is, A, find me on Twitter on X at Raoul, R-A-O-U-L, G-M-I. You can find me there. And there's a link tree there that shows all of the various things that I do, because I run several businesses. Global Macro Investor, which is my high-end research, Real Vision, also XPAM, Exponential Age Asset Management. I have a crypto fund of hedge funds. So we're one of the largest investors in crypto hedge funds. So I have that business as well, and then a bunch of other things. So I'm a busy person. Go to the Twitter feed, you can find it there, or you can find me on LinkedIn.
Everybody listening, go on Fuck Your Future. Follow Real Vision. Check out Paul. Check out Raoul. I look forward to doing this again in person, hopefully soon, now that we're both here on island. I want to thank you. I know you're a very busy man, so thank you for taking the time to come on the show, and hope we can do this again soon.
All right, my friend. I look forward to it.
Raoul has this fascinating way of weaving in education with market insights and humor to get his point across. And I think that's what makes him so relatable. His trade insights make sense. And that's because he takes the time to explain the underlying market dynamics that are driving his decisions. I would strongly encourage anyone who is curious about macroeconomics to invest the time needed to really grasp how central banks influence economic cycles. It has made me a much better investor, and there are many great educational resources out there that are also very fun, like the Ledin blog and the Real Vision community, which I strongly encourage you to check out. I hope you've enjoyed the conversation with Raoul, and we'll be back soon with another great guest. If you enjoyed this Because of Bitcoin episode, I would be very grateful for the 5 seconds it would take you to drop us a review and give us a rating on your favorite podcasting platform. This will really help us reach even more listeners. And if you'd like to learn more about Bitcoin, be sure to check out our newsletter by subscribing at ledn.io. That's ledn.io. Again, this was Mauricio Di Bartolomeo. Stay tuned for our next episode. And until then, muchas gracias y los quiero mucho. Ciao, ciao.